Hello, everyone. Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. And we're really playing with your paradigm with this particular interview today. Paradigm being a collection of ways that we think in order to define ourselves, and that kind of can stick us. But a lot of us know that at this time in history, this time on the planet, we're able to move out of those stuck, repetitive paradigms of thought and being. And I have a wonderful interviewee. I always say that because those are the people I like talking to, the wonderful ones. And we have a wonderful one today who is right down there by the beach in California right now. She's a real beach, I would say beach bum, but she's a pretty high-frequency beach bum. So welcome to the show, Aaliyah Marr.
Hey, how you doing, Veronica?
I'm doing really well, and I know that you are an artist extraordinaire, and you're a creative consultant, you're a coach, and you have a real assortment of creative projects behind you. You've got books, you have several books, and you have tarot cards, and you've got quite a history of teaching art in various places, and you even studied it in France, darling, in France. I love that idea. How romantic. So let's talk about you and what you're doing and what you want to do, and let's talk about your tarot cards, your Kickstarter, and the books you've done, and you. So who's Aaliyah Marr?
Well, it changes every day. I don't know. I think it actually, the definitions become limitations. And so for me, it's always been this idea of finding out who I'm not rather than who I am.
Uh-huh.
And so that exploration of who you're not, of things outside of the definitions that you have used to block yourself in to keep yourself from growing, which is basically all definitions, you know.
But if you take away all the identities that the world sees us with, are we not infinitely possible still? Isn't it always a process of moving?
Well, that's always been a process for me of uncovering the real self underneath, which doesn't have any definitions. It's an infinite nature. The being inside has the infinite nature. So it's always like a return home. You know, we come into this world, into a world that's very dense. It's got definitions and hierarchies and limitations. And that's sort of like a little structure that we grow inside. You know, when you have children, you have to give them limits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that we're children in nature. No, we're masters of energy. We're masters of creativity.
But it's really hard to discover that, isn't it, for people? I mean, what you're talking about is our, what would you say, multidimensional self?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's also the higher self. I think of the self that's on the earth as being like a little scout ship for the mothership. Mm-hmm. The mothership being your higher self, the larger part of you that could not squeeze into this reality because it's so limited and so constrictive.
Well, I think squeezing into implies limitations, doesn't it? And squeezing into implies that that's what reality is, right?
This reality, mm-hmm. which is only one of many, many, many parallel universes and parallel realities within those parallel universes. So
how did you discover all that? I mean, what were you like as a child? Did you already know that kind of thing? A lot of children do, eh?
Yeah, I think I was awake around 3 years old when I broke my leg.
Hmm.
And I realized that my mother had no idea who I was. That's when I really woke up. I was like an adult peering out of a child's eyes.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And everything around me seemed upside down and backwards. And I had a strong attraction to ancient things. You know, the more ancient, the more interested I was.
Hmm.
I had an attraction to science fiction.
Hmm.
You know, your attractions, your likes, your dislikes, those are like guideposts to rediscovering things within yourself that's, you know, knowledge that you've always had. We don't learn anything. We simply relearn it. We simply remember it.
Well, so when you were tiny, were you, like I know you didn't read science fiction at three, But did you have a sense of multidimensionality of the universes? What did you perceive at that age that you remember?
All I remember was having an interest in things like, I used to read Alice in Wonderland, I remember. I used to read it all the time because that kind of logical illogic made sense to me. Mm-hmm. And then when my father introduced me to quantum physics somewhere around the age of 14, it made sense to me.
Wow, your dad introduced you to quantum physics, so he was on the path in a way, was he?
Oh, I think now that my father was originally from Atlantis, and I believe my mother was one of the Earth's religion people.
Oh.
And,
Like what, like a Wicca sort of thing? Or Earth?
Yes, like somebody who was very much in love and respected the Earth. She taught us from a very early age to not fear anything, to respect everything, to think of it as being equal to us. Now, how many people have an education like that from their mother?
I didn't.
She was like Gaia. No, there were many ways that she was messed up too, but because living in this world just kind of screwed you over. But she was very nature based. You know, her religion
was
nature.
Great. Hey, that was wonderful. Yeah. So you had nature based as the mother and quantum physics as the father. I mean, that's
My father was a philosopher scientist.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so I always like to say the body of the mother and the mind of the father. So
isn't that great?
Yeah, my mind works more like my father's mind. I have a very, show me kind of approach. You know, like somebody can tell me that they experienced angels or God or whatever. And I'm like, well, that's really nice for you. But I don't believe it until, to me, beliefs don't matter. It's what I experience and then what I know. Hmm. And when I know it, it's a type of knowing in my body. Like, that's truth for me.
Hmm.
It may not be truth for anyone else, but it's for me.
So, like, if somebody says that they see angels and you don't know it, but you get, I mean, how do you find it in your body? Do you get a wisp of it, or do you have an experience, or what?
When I find something, it's because it's direct experience, which is very close to the shamanistic approach. If you think about it, a mystic or shaman approaches life directly. They don't take what other people have said. They don't go through social structures like religions or anything like that. They are going for direct experience.
Mm.
All the people who were looking for enlightenment, so-called enlightenment, or for personal ascension, were looking for that direct experience.
Mm.
They're not looking for, climbing up the ladder of, social structures or belief systems or anything like that. All of them have to have a practice of dumping belief systems,
mm-hmm.
and a rigorous inner discipline, which is something I had at a really early age.
Really?
Yeah, I remember I was addicted to books, okay? So I read out the entire science fiction library in the whole town. We're talking about all the library systems. And I don't know how old I was. I couldn't have been more than sixth grade. I don't even know how old you are in sixth grade, but
yeah.
I was an avid, avid reader. And I got to the point when I was 14 years old that I was reading 3 books a day.
Wow.
And that's I also liked historical fiction.
Mm.
Now that was really skimming books. And so I made a decision to stop being passive with my entertainment. And so I locked myself in my room, away from the TV set, didn't allow myself to read books, and started creating things.
Ah, what did you create, darling?
Well, I wrote poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I started to do artwork.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was an artist. I'm a fourth generation artist.
Oh.
Yeah,
so your mother would be in approval if you're hiding out doing your own thing, right?
Yes. She didn't really understand it, but
even though she was an artist?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Although she always approved of my artwork. She says, oh, your work is so much better than mine.
Oh, really?
Well, she waylaid by, you know, the normal things of life. You know, she never pursued the artwork past college.
Mm.
And so she, you know, she got a job and then she got a family and, you know, had, you know, children to take care of and things like that. So she never persisted with the artwork. Then, but for her, it wasn't the same thing. You see, for her, it was capturing something, you know, trying to draw it realistically.
Mm.
For me, it was a spiritual connection. So my reason for doing artwork was completely different from hers.
Okay.
And she didn't really get it. She couldn't understand things like, you know, basic, some things that are, you know, mystical. She couldn't understand mystical things. She thought somebody was trying to kind of like pull one over on her and say something. So it's a different kind of mentality, you know.
But your dad was mystical, was he? Your dad was a philosopher.
Yes, he was, but he was also very religious. And
but it's interesting because I look at you and your inner soul, and I go, you had to be mystical, whether your dad was a plumber or a philosopher, you know.
You mean the self would be whatever the self was.
Yeah.
I feel my father was this amazing. Both my parents were amazing teachers, and they had very different things to teach.
Hmm. How many children did they have? Did they have a lot of children? Do you have siblings?
Yes, they had 4 kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very, all of them very different. Yeah. But to give you an idea that when I was about 14 again,
mm-hmm.
I said to my father, thinking he would understand it, but not really explaining it, because I guess even at 14, I didn't really know how to articulate what it really meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him something that just blew him away. I said, you know, Pop, we used to call him Pop. It doesn't really matter whether Jesus Christ lived or not. And there was this huge silence.
Was he angry?
No. And my father wouldn't get angry at somebody for thinking.
Mm.
But he didn't know what I meant, nor did I know. But I remember it to this day that what I meant was that the symbology of somebody living on earth who represented those principles. Basically, now I understand that the concept of Christ is a concept of the evolved man, of the, I think it's called him the Adam Kadam.
Oh right.
Is that right?
Okay.
And so this evolved man is the epitome of bringing love, the vibration, a higher vibration, to material forms. It's really not the spirit being evolved, because you can't evolve a spirit. It is what it is. But the actual concept, bringing those ideas down into the culture of the time, which was eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, very violent, very primitive kind of social organization. To bring that into that time period, like the beginning of the Piscean Age,
okay,
and to bring it in was a very outrageous and evolutionary act. So the concept, which is, I understand the world as symbols, just as Seth says in Jane Roberts' work.
Mm-hmm.
Seth says everything is a symbol.
Okay.
And so the idea of Christ as a symbol, as an evolutionary tool, it could be a myth. It could be a total myth, like people talk about mythology as if, you know, it wasn't real to people. Well, it was real to people.
Mm-hmm.
Because
we know deep down, don't we? We know when a symbol has vitality and that it reeks of truth, even though it's only a symbol, right?
Right. Well, when you realize that everything is a symbol, then even yourself, what you think of as yourself, then you have the ability to change the meaning behind it, or to absorb the meaning behind it, or to use it as a launch pad for new ideas and new thought patterns.
And I think also, or another way to put this is perhaps seeing things as symbols means each of them is a gateway. Each of the ones
right.
you're focusing on is a gateway to, infinity, evolution.
Now, what's really interesting about that is when I began to see each card in the tarot deck as being one of those gateways or tunnels into.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the tarot deck is a tool for self-evolution.
Okay.
This is why it was banned by several churches, because the church did not want you to try to evolve yourself. They want you to, any social organization, the purpose of it is to maintain itself.
That's right.
Sort of like an organism. And it's not really intended for the evolution of the individuals inside of it. Mm-hmm. But with people like me do, we're kind of like avatars. We go out and we explore, we scout, we try to push the envelope within ourselves.
Right.
Well, that doesn't really sit well with a social organization.
Yeah, do you call yourself an avatar?
No, I just did, but I don't normally do that.
Okay. But it's an interesting way to put that word, which we think of as out there and them, into the evolutionary process within yourself or with others that you can relate to, right?
Well, one of the processes of waking up is to wake up to one's own wisdom
mm-hmm.
without having ego about it.
Right.
And that, I think part of that idea comes from the ability to put humbleness with power, or humbleness and responsibility, humbleness with power, is the ability to understand that your truth is your truth, and that follows one of the laws of the universe. So if somebody was to say, well, this is true over here, then you respect that because it's true for them. But you don't allow people to tell you what's true for you.
Mm.
And so if I said that Jesus Christ was just a symbol and not a real being, now I don't know that for true, but for me, it rings true to me to focus on the symbology and the message that he had to give.
Because he was clear that anything I can do, you can do better. He was clear.
Well,
He never said that, did he?
No, his whole purpose was to help people evolve to the state of being like himself, which is an awake being, a godlike being, a person who is that, and that doesn't question what they are, but allows everyone else to be what they are. And that's the definition of humbleness, Any godlike being would not require worship out of anyone.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. If they're truly godlike. Now, if they're acting like petty human beings, and we can look at the Greek gods and poo-poo that, right?
Right.
And say, look how selfish and petty they are.
Right, and competitive and jealous and dominant .
Right, and so they're ascribing all those human qualities to those beings. But what they're not doing is understanding the metaphoric relationship, the symbology of the God itself, and including the ones that we set up in this system, like the government. I mean, that's a type of God.
Your phone bopped out, so what? Say it again.
Well, like the government or the social system or the laws or whatever concepts that we have, we set them up. We forget that we originated the concept.
Right.
And so we can always go back and say, well, we're the originators of these concepts. We can change this anytime.
So we set them up in a fear consciousness.
Right. And that's one of the major things that I've discovered in the last few years is through my lifelong exploration with the nature of consciousness. And really what I was always questioning was how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized that we live inside of this matrix of control, which I've known since I was 3, but we live inside a matrix of control that does not benefit our own personal evolution
mm-hmm.
within matter, the realm of matter. I'm not saying the spirit really evolves, but the scout Scout does within matter, or actually what the Scout is trying to do is bring love into this realm. What we have on this, what causes the matrix to be what it is it's based upon a single false concept.
A single what?
Now remember, a single false concept.
Okay.
Okay. So I think of it like a pyramid that's upside down, that's balanced with its point on a single grain of sand.
Mm-hmm.
That single grain of sand is the concept. If we take that concept away, now that concept is one of separation. That's the core concept that, and I was going to say fear at one point, and now I know fear is caused by separation. Mm-hmm. So this concept that there can be separation, that you can be separate from your God, you can be, you know, but the nature of the universe is that the creator cannot live outside his creation. God cannot stand outside of nature. God cannot be outside of you. That is the nature of consciousness, the way the actual reality works. So if you remove that one single grain of sand, the pyramid collapses into rubble, which resembles an upright pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have instead of that concept is in the natural thing, which is the natural thing, is that there is nothing here but consciousness. And you can choose that consciousness because you are the creator of what you see. And that, so if you say, Bashar says, you don't look in the mirror and expect the reflection to smile first.
Mm-hmm.
Because all you're looking at around you, no matter what you're looking at, whether it's an ant on the ground, this is a mystic's approach.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever is out there is actually me. When I accept that, then I cannot believe anymore in separation. And when I don't believe in separation, fear goes away.
Mm.
So what do you have instead? If you no longer base your paradigm upon separation and fear, and you return back to what's natural, because when you take away the unnatural thing, the natural thing flows back. What you have instead is the universe has to be based upon love.
Mm.
Which was the message of Christ and all the leaders, all the mystics.
Okay, so for the sake of people listening to us right now, why, even though that's true, everything is me, why is that so hard to grok at times?
Why? I love that word.
Well, you probably are familiar with it.
Yes.
It just is, it's easy to say everything's an illusion, and it's easy to say everything is me, and so on, but there's this little tricky part, which is actually perceiving that in a deep knowing being level, huh?
Well, I think it's part of the nature of the density of matter, and that if we talk about, you know, I don't want to get lost in the differences between density and dimension, but you know, let's just talk about it as if it's dimension, and then we'll go from there. But you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, say 10 dimensions, okay?
Yeah.
And we're on third dimension, which means that we can see first and second, okay? So if you think of third dimension as having sort of roundness, you know, like solidity, you know, it's you know, the first dimension is a point, second dimension is a line, the third dimension is, you know, what we think of as our reality system, which is, you know, solidity, you know, shapes. Then the fourth dimension, some people say, is time. You know, that's sort of a classic approach. But when you get into quantum physics, you realize the fourth dimension is not time. But what I always say is third and fourth dimension have to live together, because in order to have matter, you have to have time for it to exist in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you can't have something just appear and then to disappear. You wouldn't have any time for this to exist. So what we have is we added the important element of time to this. And what that means is that time keeps us from noticing how our thoughts are making things. A time is like the buffer. So it protects us. But it also,
you mean it keeps us from seeing that everything we think is manifesting? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly.
Interesting.
So it's the buffer.
Mm-hmm.
Because when
time is the buffer.
It keeps us from. It's a buffer, right? It's sort of like you put kids in a playpen. You know, you put them in a. You don't put them like out in the street, right?
Yeah.
You put in a little playpen. And the protection is time.
Mm-hmm.
So it protects us from, like, suddenly, you know, when we're unconscious and we're having a lot of fear-based thinking, like, oh, what if terrorists came and attacked? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that's all controller being thinking, right? There's real reasons why that thinking existed. But let's just say, for instance, you have a whole bunch of people and you're trying to evolve them in consciousness. You wouldn't allow them to think those horrible thoughts and then have them instantly appear.
Right.
So there has to be like a buffer zone while you're unconscious. The more conscious you get, the less buffer zone there is.
Okay.
So this is why synchronicity seems to work really well. The more that you relax your fear.
Can we develop, that's an interesting segue. Can we develop synchronicity by wanting to?
Well, that's an interesting thought. Well, I was thinking, like, for instance, have you ever visualized a parking space and then you found that parking space?
Yeah, pretty much always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right. Why is that you can do that, but you can't do, say, you know, visualize $1 million?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you why.
Why?
It's your fear. It's your resistance to that idea. It's your belief system that's stopping you. So let me back it up a little bit, because this is really core to my philosophy and
okay.
what I've discovered. When I was 20-something, when I was in Paris, I was 20 years old. And
how exotic to be in Paris at 20.
I know. I was studying art at L'École Nationale Supérieure des Beaux-Arts
mm-hmm.
in Paris, which is the National School of Fine Arts. It's the top-level school of art in Paris, and some say in the world. I don't know. I mean, all the greats went there. Not saying they graduated, but they went there. Picasso, people like that. Okay.
Could you just feel that? Could you feel the history of the greats be there?
That was such an extraordinary experience, but that's a whole different talk. But it was very interesting place to be, and a very interesting time to be there, particularly in my life. But anyway, somebody handed me a book when I was in this cafe. I was sitting in this cafe. I lived in the Rue Mouffetard, which is one of the oldest streets, dates from the Middle Ages in Paris. And I lived in this little hotel that probably dated from the Middle Ages in Paris. And a slab door for, you know, slab, and all the floors slanted, you know, like severely slanted.
How exotic. You know? For those of us in a very new country, that's kind of exotic.
Yeah. And I would look out, and I could see this square, and it was lit by street lights at night, but everything else was in darkness. Right? Mm. So one day I'm sitting in that cafe, it was at night, and this woman, I didn't have any friends that spoke English when I was there. And so this woman started talking to me, and she was American. And I said to her, I said, you know, it's really funny. All my life I felt like I was in a stage, like on a theater. Like, and when I was a child, actually, I had this fantasy that I thought it was a fantasy, that I was the only real human left on Earth, and that
wow.
I was being studied by aliens in sort of like terrarium of humanity. Like everyone around me was not really real, that they were not really human. They were just sort of facsimiles. And there was no such thing as a holodeck, you know, like no, there was no idea of holograms or anything like that at the time. But that's what I thought I was in. I thought I was in this like facsimile of humanity.
The Truman Show or something, yeah.
Yeah. So I told her, I said, it was really strange because this cafe seemed like a stage setting and everything that went beyond the light was no longer there. And she looked at me and handed me this book and disappeared. And the book was one of Carlos Castaneda's books.
Uh-huh.
That book changed my life. I have never, ever seen anything that came close to the way the shamans describe the world.
Hmm.
And one of the things that they say, which has really held me in good stead my whole life, is that the world is a description. It's your description. Now, there's collective description, which is to get back to what we were saying earlier about how hard it is to, you know, maintain idea of oneness with everything. Mm-hmm. There's the collective description, which is what they call the mitote. Don Miguel Ruiz in the Four Agreements calls it the mitote. The mitote basically means a gathering where everyone is talking.
Oh, really?
So as they talk, they're describing the world. So they're talking in everything. When you take a baby, actually sees energy directly.
Right.
What the Castaneda group were trying to do was to see energy directly. They were not trying to describe it. They were just trying to see it, to understand it, to feel it, to not understand in a mental word, but to understand it with their bodies, you know, to see what reality really is underneath all the appearances. So the mitote is a group description. So there's a collective agreement about the world that holds the world as it is. If you change the base level agreement, the whole world changes. Hmm. And it took them their whole lifetimes to overcome their beliefs and to use their energy in a way that described that allowed them to see the world directly.
Hmm.
And the main thing that prevents this is what's called self-importance. And what self-importance is bolstered by is fear. And once you drop the fear, self-importance disappears. You don't need to protect yourself, and then you really see.
Hmm.
And a lot of people are afraid of that. So it's the belief systems that you're trying to overcome, the emotional attachments, to be able to really be the powerful being you really are.
But the thing is we get caught up in the need for identity in order to seem powerful to the collective, right?
Well, that all comes from self-importance, which is the thing you're always trying to dethrone.
Right.
You never get rid of it. It's what people call the ego.
Okay.
But the ego, what people call the ego, is really an unhealthy ego. You can't get rid of anything in your makeup. You can only reassign its importance.
Okay.
So once you take the ego and say, you're no longer the leader, and you allow the heart to lead, then the ego can drop back into its natural position, which is a kind of, you know, filter system.
Right.
You know, that it can be very helpful. In a less dominant role.
But it takes a kind of an awakening to be able to be more facile or more movable, malleable with some of these aspects of being a human being, doesn't it?
Yeah, it takes a lifelong discipline. They work their whole lives to get to that point. Now, they were working in a much denser form of reality than we're really in.
Well, now here's the thing. I think I emailed you this, that I personally see huge waves of change going through the universes, right? And there are several
right.
people I've mentioned it to who say, no, it's not like that. But I feel it is that a lot of what you're talking about with the collective agreement and seeing energy and so on, I think, from what I've seen, and you've probably got more illumination on this than I have at this moment, but I think that these shifting frequencies, shifting waves way out in that are sometimes even making galaxies bounce, I think are bringing in a much different frequency level that we can ingest or contain or use or ride or surf or whatever in order to make it possible to shift our collective agreements more swiftly or more thoroughly?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's been happening. When 2012 started, that year started, this little phrase burst out of me and it said, oh my goodness, we're in the Wild West.
Yeah, I've heard that from people, yeah.
Yeah, and what
but it is the Wild West, because the tent poles, the pegs that have held things in place are moving very
right.
fast, leaving a kind of chaos, which to me is sort of reflective of the very thing I was trying to say, the shifting frequencies that are actually coming in.
Right. Well, what was happening, what I saw, was that the third dimensional peg pole, just like you're saying, the pegs were removed,
yeah.
and that we were suddenly now opened up to fourth dimensional and above.
Hmm.
And that fourth dimensional layer, as you know, there's an lower astral layer, which is rather confused, and there was a lot of emotional. I think a lot of that's been cleaned up, but a lot of the leftover, you know, whenever anyone thinks somebody has something or has an emotion, it kind of goes somewhere. It doesn't ever leave. And so there was like a layer of that in lower fourth. So we kind of got exposed to a lot of that, you know, and that was a lot of karma, what people call karma, which is basically those emotions. But we also have this ability to overcome that.
My guidance has been saying for a while now, it's the time for you to step out of that pool, out of the karma.
Oh, yeah.
Time.
Yeah.
They also say, and you can correct this part or add to it, that they also say it's always about choosing that. It doesn't just leave you. It can run through you all you want, you know?
Well, that's the thing about fourth dimension. It's about choice. If you think about fourth dimension as being actually a space of no time,
mm-hmm.
where what you think is instant in front of you,
mm-hmm.
That the only thing that you have then is choice of what to think. Now, in third dimension, you don't have choice. You only have lesser of two evils, which is more of reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth dimension, you suddenly have choice.
But if you have choice, Aaliyah, then you don't have hierarchy. You can't have hierarchy because we're all choosing in the moment, right?
Well, I love the word hierarchy because hierarchy really relates to a third dimensional illusion.
Yeah.
But, what I mean by choice is that choice represents godlike power.
Okay,
so if we say to have that godlike power, you have to have the responsibility of being able to make choices, to make discernment and then choose. So really, choice is a matter of preference, because if everything is equal and you understand everything is equal, then the only thing that can make you move is to have a discernment or a preference.
Right, okay.
Okay, so it's equal in value, but one is not better than another. You know, there's nothing but perfection when you're in that state. But the only way that you can move in that state with anything resembling what we know is to move through desire. So you have to access your power of choice, and you have to have responsibilities, because with power comes responsibility.
So, tell me more about that. So you see, I have to have responsibility. Well, I sweep my floor. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, to make a powerful choice, one needs to be not in fear anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And because if you're going to be in fear, then you're making choices that are either directed to you by someone who benefits from your fear, or are default choices that you've always made because of your fear.
But so that a responsibility that we have is to recognize the fear and then choose to release it, right?
Well, that's preliminary to having the choice, because, yes, you cannot have the fear and have choice.
Right.
So responsibility comes with power and freedom.
Right.
So that's what people are afraid of assuming their godlike beingness, because they're afraid that it means they're going to be egotistical. But a godlike being or God being cannot be egotistical, because they understand equality and they understand free will and they understand connection. They understand oneness. So you could not say, I'm going to go and cut off that person's leg, because it would be like cutting off your own.
Right.
So you cannot have irresponsibility and have godhood, which is why any god that talks about, you know, killing other people and things like that would be a violation of its own nature. And it wouldn't be possible, because that a conscious being cannot create something that's outside its own consciousness. It's a law of consciousness. The god cannot stand outside his creation.
Mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
Yeah, there's no bubble that God exists in outside of this world. So if mystic would see God in everything.
Yeah.
And the mystic wouldn't even name God. They'd say, by naming him, I'm trivializing or bringing into a sexuality, I'm making him like me, therefore I'm making him petty. So
right.
For me to understand to really understand the nature of the world, which is the mystic's whole impulse, his whole mission, is to understand without being able to articulate it. You know what they say, you know, if I can point at the moon, but that's not the moon. You know, that the word is not, it's like the wonderful artist René Magritte, who had this picture of a pipe, you know, an old style smoking pipe, you know, just a picture, real simple, stupid looking picture of this pipe. And underneath it says, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe," which means this is not a pipe. It's written in the picture. He's
so,
trying to show that the concept is not the same.
Right, okay.
We confuse, we're so confused by the images that we project, by the illusion that we've projected, that we don't understand that we're the projector.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
But that's it, yeah. So when we're talking, let me see now. We're talking about individuals and getting to a point of choice, right? Then we're also talking about the collective agreement, and we're talking about the releasing of beliefs and attitudes that contain us and keep us in a fear base, right? A limited space, right?
Right.
So what do you, and you mentioned 2012. You can see where I'm going with all this. I'm going, okay. So what is the impact on the collective right now with the collective agreements, where we have a tremendous amount of killing going on? We have very frightened people, and we have very dominant, scary media, right? And what do you think is happening? Is there collective choice? How do we know all that sort of thing?
Well, there's a lot of players that people are not aware of.
Okay.
One of the things that I talk about in my book, Unplugged from the Matrix, is there, I connected the dots between what I studied with Castaneda and what I learned myself in terms of other venues and things like that. And so I wrote this last summer, and it came through just like really fast. You know?
So you channeled it, did you?
I would say probably, although it really, there's a lot of my own experience in it, but.
And what's
so
it called again? Unplugged from the Matrix?
Yes, it's called Unplugged from the Matrix. And it wasn't originally that I didn't know what I was writing. I thought I was just writing an essay or something, and it turned into a book. It was actually two books, and so I separated it out. And then at some point, the title came through to me.
Okay.
When the title came through to me, I realized then that I could take all the quotes from the Matrix movie, and when I put them in the book, it suddenly made a lot more sense. And so then I'm like, wow, this movie is really, I mean, I knew it when I saw it, but I, you know, someone told me they read the book, they're like, oh my goodness, I can't even believe how much power that, you know, those quotes put in the context of your book really do make sense. So what Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda's book said is that there is a being that came from the universe, from the cosmos, that saw all these humans on Earth who were a beautiful conglomeration of energy fields. They had like a kind of energy that was on the outside of their aura.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy, those beings, their favorite food is fear.
Oh, yes. Okay.
What they did is they came here and they installed a society that benefits them, that is based upon fear. And they feed off of it. They breed us like animals.
Mm-hmm.
They cause wars. They've actually done something even more nefarious, which is really crazy. They did what Don Juan said, they gave us their mind.
Hmm.
Now, that mind is where hierarchy lives. It's where lesser than or greater than. It's where value systems live. You know, nothing has any value but what we have collectively given it.
Well, wait a second. Now, did they have a collective agreement? Is that what you're saying? They have a collective agreement to dominate,
no, what they,
and slave.
Yes, their mission, or what they learned to do, mm-hmm. was to dominate humanity and feed off the fear that humanity can generate, because they love fear. And it is that they are inorganic beings. They're not organic beings. They are a form of consciousness that does not have an organic nature.
Really?
So they're immaterial in the sense, they're fourth dimensional beings. They're beings that exist only just like ghosts or people that, you know, get out of the physical form, they end up in fourth dimension for a while. And that fourth dimensional beingness is like they can still act upon the people here, but they don't have form.
Well, so what about the elite that we hear about? What about the...
The elite are what I call the minions of the controller beings.
Okay. So these are called controller beings, are they?
I call them controllers, and I found out later on other people are starting to do that, too. So
yeah, I've heard that before, too.
Yeah. So the controllers could not act directly in this dimension because they don't have bodies.
Mm.
So what they did is they started to enlist humans, kind of like a devil's contract, you know, although I don't believe in the devil. It's, you know, it's kind of devilish when you think about it. Well, it is. It's very kind of evil when you think about it.
Right.
But I don't pertain to those kinds of thoughts anymore. So, you know, I don't think of them as evil. I just think of them as like a natural predator. They're just like a predator. They came here and saw like a food source. And then they saw a way to, like, farm the food source, just like we farm animals, you know, so there's nothing different from what they did opposed to what we did.
But if we're talking about awakening and we're talking about choice, do we have a choice, or is that just like a fait accompli? Are we just little...
For a long time, we didn't. And so there is what people call star seeds, these beings, what... Dolores Cannon called the three waves of volunteers. When the atom bomb was exploded, the sort of galactic neighbors, these beings that seeded this planet with their own DNA. We're a conglomeration of a lot of different sources.
Okay, so we're different than just being these little beings that are being run by controllers, right?
Well, yeah. Let's just say that there's, from what I understand, I don't understand the whole thing. I just understand these pieces. And so, from what I understand, there's sort of humanity that's sort of working on its own sort of evolutionary path, right? There's Gaia, which is the Earth, which is its own being and a consciousness of itself. The Sun, which is a consciousness of itself. A higher consciousness, and perhaps, you know, or a bigger consciousness. It's hard to say, you know, when you don't believe in higher or lower anymore. But anyway, let's just say that sort of like the average person on the planet has like a karmic history on this planet. Now, that was kind of serving the controller beings, because what they would do is it's kind of getting hurt in a war. You go into the hospital, which is the fourth dimension, you know, you die or whatever, and you immediately reincarnate on Earth. Well, that was not intended to be so quick. You were supposed to learn, and you know, a lot of beings come to this planet so that he can experience limitation. You know, so it's kind of like the carnival of, you know, rides or something like that.
Well, did we just choose to come here so we can do that? Is that what we came for? Are we a people?
I'm not sure what the average person came here for. I'm not even sure that they came here to evolve. I don't think it's a matter of evolution. I think it's kind of it was originally a recreational place, you know. It was like a way to experience a different kind of reality, to insert your consciousness into a plant or into an insect or something like that, and experience limitation, you know, to experience being in matter.
So we also came to try out McDonald's, right?
Right. But what I think the volunteers came here to do after the World War II and the bomb was exploded is that it was recognized by our galactic forefathers or neighbors in the galaxy, of which we've been a quarantined planet because of the nature of the violence here and the controller beings and everything like that. So we've been quarantined from the rest of the universe, sort of like in its own little bubble and petri dish, I like to call it. and so that's going to open up soon. And so we put in a ticket for quick evolution. And so there's a window of time in which we can do this. And so there's a lot of volunteers on this earth who woke up like me pretty early, and we've been waiting. We're like, I always saw it as like a timed missile or something, or like a, you know, like dandelions, you know, you blow on the seeds and they, you know, disperse. And
well, you're answering something I was thinking of, because a lot of us go, I'm supposed to be here right now. I'm here participating in something big, and that's what you're right. talking about, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it may not be something that seems to be really great, like, you know, like maybe you will never write that book, or you never, you know, be able to lead people out of darkness. It's really not a matter of that. It's really a matter of basically raising your vibration bit by bit by bit, you know, so that you are in control of what you accept as your reality. Like, you can say, oh, well, look at all the violence. Well, you don't know that there's violence there. That's a reporting to you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why it's reported to you. So while there may be violence there may be all this, we don't know for sure, most of us. You know, we haven't been there ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And even witnessing it, I think what's happening right now, particularly in the last, it's been very rough for those of us who have decided to do this physically, this change physically, because it's running through our bodies. You know, there's people that are kind of like laid flat for doing this transmutation of energy for years.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about the reason why it's reported that way is that it's, again, the minions of the controller beings. So the controller beings have mostly been taken off planet by now, I think. But the minions are still there. And they're running around scared. And they're trying to generate enough fear so that you can drop people back into the old controlled paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be, you know, a reality that you do at some level choose. You know, that's a possible parallel reality.
I don't understand that. You mean like you would actually be at war or something?
Well, to choose the description of reality, like you can look around you and you can see, I can focus on the war in the Middle East and say, oh my goodness, it's terrible. Look what those people are doing to each other, or people that are killing other people. Or I can focus on the flower that's in front of me.
Right.
Now, people could say that's irresponsible, but no, that's being responsible. Because that flower raises my vibration and the war lowers it.
Right. But the thing is, if you raise, change the energy, change the reality is one of my favorite tools. And that's what you're saying. Change the energy, move your energy up, right?
Well, one of the things I learned in making the tarot deck and studying the tarot deck for years was that the tarot deck in the suits itself, which are analogous to the suits in a regular playing deck, you have the hearts for cups, the clubs for swords, I think I got that right, the spades are swords, the clubs are wands, and the diamonds are pentacles.
Mm-hmm.
That we're talking about the manifestation path from energy to matter in the suits themselves. So if you go through the suits as it in the right order, mm-hmm. you see it. The wands are about energy, pure intent, desire, intent. That's the first. It comes. Everything is created from that area, not backwards. We've been taught that in order to be happy, we have to have a certain amount of money, we have to have the house or whatever. Like, that's working backwards from the material to the energetic. But we want to work from the energetic, from intent, pure intent. That's the creator being's way of creating through to matter, okay? Because that's mm-hmm. the densest thing. You go from the most etheric to the most dense, right?
Right.
From the most, yeah. So we go from wands, which is the fire, which is the energy of pure intent, to swords, which is thought, where that intent or, you know, inspiration hits your mind, becomes a thought. And when it becomes a little bit more solid, it's more concrete at that point. And then it goes to cups, which is on this plane, emotions.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And that's the key to manifesting into matter, because it's the catalyst that manifests, that takes a thought and makes it real to us into matter. I said in my first book, The Art of Creativity, that it's kind of like, you know, in Frankenstein, the story of Frankenstein's monster and
yep.
Frankenstein the scientist, he assembles these dead pieces of these dead bodies, you know, he assembles it into this monster, but it doesn't have life yet. So he puts it on a slab and he takes that slab and he pulleys it into the roof, right? And the mm-hmm. roof opens up and then the slab is on the roof and he's got this electrode attached into the monster's neck. And then lightning strikes the lightning rod and then activates the monster and makes him alive. Mm. That's emotion. Emotion takes a thought, which is dead in itself, which is the concept, and makes it into matter. We are going to be masters of materialism, masters of material reality, we have to understand and not control, but be able to direct our emotions.
Mm.
Otherwise, we create monsters.
Well, also, emotions are really sticky, so we create an agreement, if you want to call it back to that, amongst many people by passing on these sticky feelings that are not necessarily chosen, right?
Right. These sticky feelings are really what is, I call it gravity. Now, it's an agglutinizing force mm-hmm. that is the lower emotions, especially on 3D, is what keeps 3D kind of moving along, you know, keeps it in place, keeps it in form.
Is this why we're learning how to go gluten-free?
Yeah. The emotions are really, really important to be able to choose your emotions, right? If you say, okay, this person's doing this once again, you know, and at that point you actually have a cubic centimeter of chance.
Mm.
The time, the very small amount of time to decide how you are going to react to that. Are you going to choose a different emotion this time? Or are you going to go back to your feeling of being insulted or being trod upon or victimized? Because victimization is always, always, always a lower form of consciousness. It's a very unconscious state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like constantly choosing to be powerful and not go back into the fear and the defensiveness of victimization
right.
and unconsciousness. We're constantly choosing to be conscious, constantly choosing a higher and higher vibration for your own reality. That's a lot of work,
mm-hmm.
but it is the only work there is to do. Nothing else is that important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that a lot. Well, tell people, we have to end this shortly, as you well know. So tell people how to get in touch with you and your books, how to see online where there's some evidence of your amazing work and so on.
The best place to do that is, well, you can find any of my books on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm republishing some of the early ones.
And people can get on your newsletter, right?
Yeah. Go to www.parallelmindswith2z's.com. That's PARALLELMINDZZ as in zebra.com. Parallelminds.com.
And you're also a coach. You can coach some people into a much more responsibility about their resonance and their emotions, can't you?
Right. I don't know what to call myself right now, except that really what I'm really interested in is people that are creative people who want to make the world better. You know, they want to create things that actually, you know, moves us into a new paradigm.
I love
that. That's really a beautiful thought. And it doesn't take much, you know. It takes a lot to overcome one's own resistance and things like that. But ultimately, change is very easy once you set it up.
Mm.
And I do what I call creative activation. So just talking to me can activate that creative side of you, because all of you are creative. We're creating this. There's an agreement that we're creating. We can choose a different agreement. But we have to choose ourselves first. We have to choose and step into our own power first. We have to acknowledge and recognize that with respect to everyone else, you know, having respect for their free will.
Well, and here's another thing. I just running through my head, I'm going, well, empathy on an emotional level can be difficult, can keep a lot of people stuck. But when you're talking conscious creation and there's a resonance that radiates from that, it's like a conscious empathy that uplifts much of humanity as well. I mean, it can be stimulant.
Yeah. I like, I've gone between empathy and compassion, and I do think we're moving from empathy, which is resonating at the same level as someone else, or actually stepping down one's level, to compassion, where you're able to be detached, because the most important thing about emotions is to not be subject to them. In other words, you are the emitter of your emotions, therefore you're responsible for them. That ultimate responsibility means that you know that emotions are creative in nature, and that if you're a creative being, you are never, ever subject to your own emotions.
Right. That's great. Also, when people look at your art and your cards, there can be an activation in the art that's there as well, right?
Right. My deck is called the Tarot of Creativity. And it's a deck that is made up of my artwork, about 15 years of artwork, married with the traditional keywords and new keywords for the deck, based upon numerology and the tradition of the Tarot.
Wow,
so
it's wonderful.
Very modern looking.
Well, and I have to say goodbye, but I thank you, Aaliyah, for joining us. Aaliyah Marr, my goodness, you've really taken us through a deeper and more expanded and multidimensional mapping of reality. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Many blessings.